Richard, it's great. We've had you here many times before. It's great to have you here back.
Thanks for having me.
Just give us a brief sort of summary of where you work and perhaps what you're doing, what you're working on as a scientist. I'll switch out here so you can come in and use the mic.
Well, thanks, Phil, and thanks for having me. I work in London, one day a week at Queen Mary University of London in the East End, and 4 days a week at Kew Gardens in the Southwest. And at Kew, I just do research. It's a little-known fact about Kew that it's not just a lovely garden, but also has a big plant science research institute as part of it.
And what are you working on at the moment?
I work on trees, ash trees, oak trees, elm trees, birch trees, alder trees. And we essentially take...
all the trees, did you say?
Alder.
You could have just skipped straight to that, but no, okay, so all the trees.
Almus, for those who prefer the Latin. So we take methods developed for human genomics and we apply them to trees. So you know you get personalised medicine where you have your genome sequenced, and then you get told what drugs will work for you and which ones won't, etc. Well, we kind of do that except for trees. Okay. So we find out what bits of the genome make them susceptible to diseases like ash dieback, acute oak decline, Dutch elm disease.
Okay. So your field is evolutionary biology. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah. But today's topic is, can a scientist believe in miracles? I'm going to hand over to you now.
Thanks very much. Well, yeah, great question. Can a scientist believe in miracles? And it won't be any big surprise to any of you that I'm going to say yes, they can. I think Phil probably would not have invited me if I were not going to answer in the affirmative. But why do I say that? What unique perspective might I have on that as a scientist? Well, I'll try and give it a go. I think that science is revealing to us a world where miracles can happen. Now, I know not many scientists would say that, especially not that would get on the BBC, for example, so I'll explain that a little bit. And then I'll talk a bit about history. I think history is telling us about a world where miracles have happened, and I'll talk a bit about John's Gospels, which you have on your tables, which are a biography of Jesus, a historical account of Jesus, which I think gives us really good evidence that miracles have happened within recorded history. But first of all, science. Well, I spend all of my time at work doing science and studying DNA. And you'll know that all of us have a genome that encodes who we are and how our bodies function. Trees are exactly the same. So here's a couple of papers from my research group. A few years ago, we published the first genome of an ash tree. So an ash has a genome of 880 million letters of DNA. That's about a third the size of a human genome. And my lab are essentially trying to figure out what all of that means. And DNA in the genome is an incredibly sophisticated piece of software. All of us use software at work. Some of you probably write software. And you'll know how hard it is to write good software. Good software doesn't just come about through the laws of physics happening. It doesn't just come about through chance and necessity. Software needs someone to think about it and instantiate it. That's what we're seeing in the genomes of trees and every other living thing. And it's actually really, really difficult to work out what genomes are doing because they're so complicated. So I could spend the rest of my career just trying to work out the coding of an ash tree, and I know that I wouldn't have finished the job by the time I retire. As well as revealing to us the software by which living things work, modern science has revealed to us the molecular machinery that encodes, that enables us to run. Here we are zooming in on the leaf of a tree. This is an animation showing what science has revealed. We are getting at a really, really nanoscale here, looking at the places where photosynthesis takes place. And on these membranes, we have these amazing miniature motors made up of proteins, rotating extremely fast, driven by a flow of hydrogen ions across a membrane. And that is how energy is transferred from kinetic energy into chemical energy, something called ATP that moves energy around our cells and plant cells. Here's another version, for those who can see it, of this molecular motor. You can see it's something that's incredibly sophisticated. It's something where every part has to be in the right place before it will actually do its function. You can imagine that if you took a motor from a motorbike or your car and started tampering with it, you wouldn't need to make many changes before that stopped working. And of course, it's the same for these nanomachines that we run on. This is what modern science has been revealing to us over the last couple of decades. And naturally, we start to think quite existential questions as we discover things like this. And here's Professor Brian Cox on the BBC documentary Universe that first aired in 2021. He said, everywhere you look on Earth, there is complexity. So you have to ask yourself, how can it be that such complexity can emerge completely naturally in the universe? And I think that's a question that strikes us all, isn't it? It strikes us when we look at the macro structures of life, when we just look at our hand or a tree, but even more when we start to look at the nanoscale and we see the software of DNA, the nanotechnology of the living cell. Well, how does Brian Cox ask the question? Well, he asks the question in a way that deliberately excludes miracles from the outset. Notice how he said, how can such complexity emerge completely naturally? And he's like very many scientists when he asks that question. The only answer he will allow is a natural answer. And a natural answer is one that excludes the supernatural, and so it excludes miracles. So a scientist like Brian Cox, who is, I believe, an atheist, is asking the question within the framework of his atheism. How can this be explained without miracles? But for me, as someone who's a Christian and believes in God, I don't ask the question that way. I just want to know how such complexity gets here. I don't mind if science points me to an answer that's natural or supernatural. I'm open to both of them, unlike many scientists. And as soon as you are open to both possibilities, I think the evidence for a supernatural explanation for miracles actually becomes quite overwhelming. And within his atheistic framework, it's very clear that he really doesn't have much idea. No one knows exactly how life on Earth emerged. This is him on this BBC documentary. No one knows exactly how life on Earth emerged. But what we do know is that at some point, primitive cells living in the ocean began using the sun's energy to power life-giving chemical reactions. This process, known as photosynthesis, unleashed the sun's creative power and drove the evolution of complexity from primitive bacteria to plants and trees, and ultimately you and me. Now notice how little detail we're having here. We're just being told, well, evolution did it. There's part of that photosynthetic machinery composed of 46,630 atoms, all working together in an intricate machine, very efficient. It took billions of years of evolution. Well, I've got a picture here of this machine. It splits water into hydrogen and oxygen, and it's not just a sort of spaghetti of different proteins. Everything is precisely placed there so that chemical reactions can happen that we find very hard to reproduce. Nobody in the most sophisticated nanotechnology lab could even begin to hope to design something like this. And all Brian Cox can tell us is, well, it took billions of years of evolution. I don't find that a very compelling explanation without more detail, but he doesn't give more detail, and I don't know anyone who can really give much more detail than that. I asked someone who works on the structures of photosynthesis if anyone has any idea how they could have evolved by a gradualistic natural process where every step is a small step and every step is functional, which is the kind of pathway you have to have for an evolutionary explanation. And he just laughed at me and said, oh, absolutely not. No one has a clue. So my conclusion from that is that nobody knows how photosynthesis could have emerged without miracles. If we turn to Richard Dawkins, a well-known atheist, he says this about evolution. We really need Darwin's powerful crane, that is natural selection, to account for the diversity of life on Earth, and especially the powerful illusion of design. The origin of life, by contrast, lies outside the reach of that crane, because natural selection cannot proceed without it. So evolution cannot explain the origin of life, he is saying. Nevertheless, it may be that the origin of life is not the only major gap in the evolutionary story that is bridged by sheer luck. Anthropically justified. That is, we've got billions of planets where we could be sort of buying a lottery ticket for life. For example, my colleague Mark Ridley has suggested that the origin of the eukaryotic cell was an even more momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step than the origin of life. The origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was in the same order of improbability. So rather than having a process of simply gradual evolution where everything gradually gets more complicated, even an atheist like Richard Dawkins has this view of evolution, where there are these sudden jumps at major transitions. Well, these momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable steps sound to me very much like miracles. Sounds to me as if Dawkins, in all but name, is summoning up miracles to explain, even within his worldview, how we got here. Because that is what the direction that the science is pointing him to. And when we look at the fossil record is a record of sudden appearances of new complex life forms that don't change a great deal, and then another form is added to the mix. When we look at physics, most physicists I understand, I'm not a physicist of course, but I understand most of them believe that the universe started in a Big Bang. Well, what is the Big Bang if it was not a momentous miracle? So I think that it's rational to believe that the world we live in is a consequence of a series of miracles. To my mind, that is the most rational explanation for the world around us. And for me, that is quite a satisfying explanation that the evidence, the scientific evidence, is pointing me towards. So that's science. Well, what about history? Well, when we turn to the pages of history, we find evidence that miracles have happened within recorded human history. So if you want to pick up the books that you have in the middle of your tables, if you're sitting at a table, this is John's Gospel. It's a biography of the life of Jesus Christ, who, as you'll know, lived about 2,000 years ago. And John's Gospel records a series of miracles. There are seven miracles, and John uses these as evidence that Jesus is the Son of God. If you turn to page 52, near the top of that page you'll see a subheading, The Purpose of John's Gospel. And you'll see there that John writes, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples which are not recorded in this book. The signs are these miracles, like turning water into wine, feeding 5,000, etc. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John is saying, I am recording this series of miracles to persuade you that Jesus is the Son of God and that by believing you may have life in his name. Now imagine what a bad strategy of persuasion that would be if these miracles hadn't actually happened. Surely it would be much better to record a life of Jesus where there were no miracles, but lots of really great teaching and great philosophy. And maybe then you would persuade people. But if you make up a series of miracles, surely that is just going to put people off if these miracles never happened. So this is a very high-risk strategy if these miracles are not actually true. It would be quite irrational for John to be writing about these things if he didn't truly believe that they were true and they pointed us to the fact that Jesus himself is divine. Well, it might not surprise you that Richard Dawkins has a view on this very matter. The Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. Richard Dawkins writes, all were written long after the death of Jesus. All were then copied and recopied through many different Chinese whispers generations. Apologies to anyone here who's Chinese. By fallible scribes who, in any case, had their own religious agendas. So he says, okay, what happened was, John wrote his book without miracles to start with, when we were in living memory of Jesus, because at that stage it would have been very easy for everyone to realise these miracles didn't happen. And then they got added in hundreds and hundreds of years later, long after memory of the events, so that no one could actually disprove them. And on the face of it, that's quite a good argument, isn't it? Because if you were living really close to those events, you wouldn't put in those miracles if they didn't happen. From Richard Dawkins' perspective as an atheist, there's no way they could have happened, so this book must have been put together over many years. But what I like about that as a scientist is it gives us a hypothesis that we can test with the evidence. So we're asking, did this book evolve, or did it come about in one go because someone wrote it in the first century AD? And we can test that hypothesis with reference to bits of manuscript that people find in ancient collections of books, and also in papyri preserved in the sands of Egypt. And so we can say, well, here's Richard Dawkins' hypothesis that the writings of John, and there are five books by John in the Bible, they all sort of came together gradually over hundreds and hundreds of years, or John wrote them. Well, in the British Museum, not far from here, you can find a codex which is dated between 300 and 425 AD, and that contains the whole of John's Gospel and the other writings of John. So therefore we know that if evolution did occur in this text, it had to happen between John writing it and within roughly three centuries, which doesn't give us a huge amount of time for evolution. And so we can plot that on our little timeline here, and we can already see that the idea that it took hundreds and hundreds of years for this gospel to evolve is a flawed idea. If we then add in more modern discoveries of fragments of text, I've just put them here in little circles, we get right back to the second and towards the end of the, very near to the first century AD. And so this kind of fossil record of textual evidence is actually giving us very good evidence against Richard Dawkins' hypothesis that this book evolved. But if it was written by John very shortly after Jesus lived, then it does mean that he would be crazy if he was just making this up. So to my mind, Richard Dawkins' hypothesis of the evolution of this text is quite an implausible one, and in fact it's far more rational to think that John really did witness the miracles that he said that he witnessed. Otherwise it wouldn't be very persuasive. What I also love about John's accounts of these miracles is there are various features of them that I find very persuasive as a scientist. So, as a scientist, we love blind tests and we love replication. We have systems within science of trying to make sure that a hypothesis is true. And a couple of them are blind tests. So, for example, if you're giving somebody a drug, you'll have somebody else who's taking a placebo, and the people won't know what they're getting. They'll be blind to whether they have the real one or the placebo, and even the person administering them, they'll be blind to it as well. And you do that because when one set of people is cured and the other is not, you know, it's not some kind of psychological effect of them knowing that they had the real drug, or the person administering it was kind of hoping that they would get better and kind of fix the figures. You do that so that when an effect happens, you really know that it's true, because the people who brought about that effect didn't know which one was going to bring it about. And we also love it when things are repeated and repeated and repeated in different labs. And you get this in the first two accounts of miracles in John's Gospel. So the first miracle in chapter 2, and do take one of these away and read them both for yourself. I don't have time to go through them both in detail during the brief time that Phil has allotted to me this afternoon. But in that first one, you'll see that there's some servants there who Jesus tells to go and fill some jars with water. And they go and do that. But the person who then declares that the water has been turned into wine is not the servants who did that task. It is the master of the feast, who is clearly blind to what happened. He doesn't know where this glass of wine has come from, and he just says, oh, it's a glass of wine. He's completely blind to the fact that 5 minutes ago that was water. So we have a nice blind test going on there at Cana of Galilee. And we get exactly the same thing happening in the second miracle, which is Jesus healing somebody at a distance. This time it's the servants who are the blind people. They are going to tell their master that his son has got better. And they tell him the time that his son got better. They don't realise that that time is the very time when Jesus told him his son would get better. So the servants are blind to what's being tested. The master, when he hears their testimony, says a miracle must have happened. And that happens also in the same place, or near the same place, Cana of Galilee. And so as we read this gospel, there are features of the text that I find very persuasive to me as a scientist, that this is really, really good evidence that has been put together very carefully and meticulously by somebody who was an eyewitness of those events. So I think science is telling us that it's rational to believe that miracles can happen in this world, and history is telling us that they really have happened in the lifetime of Jesus Christ. Now, if that is the case, what does that mean? Well, John tells us what it means. If this is really true, it means that you can believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John is telling us that if we believe in Jesus, a miracle can happen in us that gives us life in his name. And if you read John's gospel, you'll see that the life he's promising is eternal life. He can bring us to a new birth, which gives us a fresh start and life that will go on for eternity. So what John is telling us is that Jesus not only did miracles back then, 2,000 years ago, but Jesus also does miracles today, here and now, in our hearts. He can do a miracle in us, giving us a fresh start, giving us new life that will go on for eternity. And each of us can do an experiment. This is quite scientific, I think. We can do an experiment. We can pray to God and we can say to him, please could you do that for me? Please could you come into my life? Please could you do a miracle within me? Please could you give me new life? Take away my past and my guilt and my regrets and all the bad stuff and all the deadness and give me new life and give me a fresh start. And we can experience a miracle for ourselves if we do that. That is the great miracle that God is still doing today. And I would encourage all of you, if you haven't done so before, do that great experiment. Ask God to do that to you. And you can experience for yourself his power and his ability to do miracles. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, indeed. What we're going to do now is we are going to have a Q&A time for anyone who can stay. If you need to dash back to work, that's absolutely fine. What we'll do is we'll have maybe 2 minutes now to just pause around tables, maybe discuss any questions that we've got, a chance to write them down on the Slido, or you can just stick up a hand if you've got one and you want to shout out. We'll have 2 minutes and then we'll be back together for questions, okay?
We've got a question here. How does Richard Dawkins address improbable events, if not miracles?
Yeah, that's a good question. He just says it's pure luck. So he says, well, the universe is quite big. There are lots of planets. Maybe there are so many planets in the universe that we just happen to be on the lucky one. I find that argument very unpersuasive. There was a Greek philosopher called Democritus who basically had that idea. But Democritus thought that the universe was infinitely large and infinitely old. And even then, even though he thought he had the probabilistic resources of an infinite universe, not many people were persuaded that chance could do it, even under those circumstances. And Richard Dawkins himself admits that back then atheism was intellectually implausible. But then it's ironic that when he comes to events like the origin of life, he falls back to exactly that argument. And I don't know quite how he holds all that together, because we know that the universe is finite. We know it's not infinitely old or infinitely large. And the idea that pure chance could explain the origin of life, now that we know how complex the most simple life forms are, seems to me completely implausible.
Are there any examples, I guess this is more technical, are there any examples in nature of nanomachines that aren't very good or don't work?
Well, when you sequence genomes, you do find some genes that are broken. So you do come across places in the genome where there's a gene that has got a mutation in it that's broken it. And I think that is part of the decay of the world around us, that there are broken things. But for a nanomachine to actually work, it clearly has to be very fine-tuned and very, very efficient.
Questions from the floor?
Thank you for your talk. This may be something that I may have missed this in joining the Q&A, but how would you define the term neural?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Just
I never actually.
For the recording.
Yeah. How am I defining the word miracle? That's a good question, and you didn't miss me say that. I didn't give a precise definition. I guess I'm defining a miracle as something that happens outside the normal course of natural events. So it's something that can't be explained simply by the laws of physics. It's something that is outside our normal experience.
Discussion about the philosophical basis behind some of the ways in which people hold that atheistic views.
Yeah.
How would you respond to someone who says, by, of course, invoking God in the beginning of the origin of the earth or life, you are kind of shortcutting that the aspect of discovery that still exists because we don't know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, by positing God, are you kind of shortcutting the process of discovery? I don't think so. I think you're just following the evidence to its most logical conclusion. And I think that's what science should do. You should follow the evidence wherever it leads. And you shouldn't, I don't think you should constrain yourself to just natural explanations. I think sometimes the natural world evidence can point to a supernatural explanation. And I think that's perfectly logical and rational. And I don't think believing in God does shut you off at all to science and scientific discovery and scientific explanation. I think it actually makes you more open-minded, because when somebody like Brian Cox is looking at the evidence, he's saying, I will only allow a natural explanation. Whereas for me as a Christian, I can say, well, I'm happy to consider a natural or a supernatural explanation. And I don't mind which it is, really. And so I'm the one, I think, who can follow the evidence where it leads better than someone who's actually constraining things. So I'm certainly not saying, you know, I'm not going into the lab saying everything I see just has a supernatural explanation and there's no point me invoking physics and chemistry. Yeah.
Is God only the God of miracles, or is he also the God of all reality?
Oh, definitely the God of all reality. But what I'm suggesting is that all reality began with miracles.
And the miracle, what you're talking about there is creation.
Yeah.
In the beginning, God made the heavens and
yeah.
the
earth. Yeah, so, you know, if you want to call part of that the Big Bang, if you want to call part of that the Cambrian explosion, etc., etc., I'm suggesting that these big events where things suddenly appear are best understood as miracles.
Can you give a sense of the probability of life versus number of planets there are, size of the universe, etc.?
A bit out of my field, but essentially no. I think If you think about what you need to get the simplest life form has to be something that can self-replicate and pass on genetic information that encodes its structures. And until you have that, you don't really have life. And 150 years ago, people thought that life could just come about on a loaf of bread. If you left it long enough, it would go mouldy, and that's because mould just spontaneously arose. Life just started. We now know that that is completely wrong, and that even the most simple forms of life are incredibly complicated, and you have to have them there. You know, they don't just spontaneously come about. And the more we discover about science, the more we realise it's really, really, really complicated. And the idea that that could just arise spontaneously by chance, I couldn't give a number, but the probability is so low that I just don't think it's plausible.
What's happening in the scientific field as these discoveries are being made, so obviously, so the last, say, the last 20, 25 years, are people changing their minds about Darwinian evolution, even whether Christian or not?
Yeah, some people are, but I think many people are very confined by the idea that they can only use natural explanations. So the only good logical rational explanation is a natural one. And so they would either be saying, well, we don't know the answer yet, but we will one day we will have a natural explanation for this. Or they're just sort of shrugging their shoulders and thinking about something else.
One more question here from Simon, and I've got one more, and then I think we'll be done. Science tells us a lot of hows, how this works, how this was made, etc. How can we hopefully tell our colleagues about the why of science and the God behind it? I think that's from a question.
Yeah, so I think the question is absolutely right, that, and I haven't really addressed this very much, that the great thing that the Bible does is tell us the why for everything. Why does all of this exist? And of course, science doesn't explain that at all. I've been very much focused on the hows and the evidence from history and science. But yeah, there's this whole other level of questioning. Why are we here? What's it all about? And that simply cannot be answered by science.
Finally, Richard, I think we probably need to go many years back, but could I ask you, what do you personally find so compelling about Jesus? You talked a lot about science. You're obviously a well-respected scientist, but what do you find personally so compelling about him? What makes you believe that he is the Son of God who's given you eternal life? I ask you that question.
Well, There are so many things that impress me about Jesus that it's almost different every day. I'd say right now it's the patience he had. You know, you read about his life, and you know, when he was taken before Pilate for his trial and beaten up by soldiers and mocked, you know, he was tired, he was hungry, he was feeling ill, and these people were disrespecting him a huge amount. And yet he never got angry. He never responded to them negatively. He just patiently bore it and just carried on thinking about other people. And I think partly because of the stage of life I'm at, with four small kids at home and, you know, a lot of different responsibilities coming from all different angles, I know how easy it is for me just to, you know, get a bit angry with some things that happen. And then I see Jesus, who just put up with so much more and just stayed patient and calm and thinking of others all the time. The more I experience of life, the more I realise how incredible that is. And so it's not actually a sort of miracle in terms of doing something to the natural world. It's just a miracle of his personality and his character. Yeah, yeah.
And you'll see that as you read through any of these Gospels, really. Take this away and read it. We'd love you. It's yours to take away. Read it slowly. Come back and ask for some help to understand it if you'd like that. We're here every